It's Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. When people bring up the name Dwight Gooden, it's often in reference to a star that had fallen. A promising career derailed by personal demons. None of this is false. Gooden had the potential to be one of the best. But for many reasons, it seemed, Gooden was unable to shake his problems and keep his career on track long enough for him to be considered one of the all-time greats. But consider this. In 1985, Doc Gooden led the league in wins. He led the league in ERA. He led the league in strikeouts and innings pitched and complete games. There's a stat called ERA Plus, which takes a player's ERA and compares it to that of others in the league that year and adjusts for ballpark. By this measure, Gooden was 129% better than the average pitcher that year. That's not a typo. 129%. He was an all-star that year, won the Cy Young in a landslide, and finished fourth in MVP voting, though going by wins above replacement at least, he should have won that too. In the integration era, again going off wins above replacement, Gooden's 1985 season was the best season for a starting pitcher ever. Not bad for a guy who was, 20 years old. Without possibility, there is no hope. If there is nothing on the other side, then there's nothing to look forward to. But youth exemplifies possibility. Time is a constant, and time is against us. But the young have an upper hand. They can reach the other side because they have the time to get there. The same goes with baseball. Players have good stretches and good seasons, but to be considered one of the true greats, they have to get an early jump. And when they do, it engrosses us. We can't look away. We watch these very young men do amazing things, and we root for them because they have possibility. They bring hope. Baseball is repetition, but when a young phenom comes up, the game and the way we engage with it changes. And all we can do is whistle softly, shake our heads, and watch. From the Ferpo Marbury Memorial Studios in Minneapolis, Minnesota, this is Stealing Home. I'm David Temple. This episode is dedicated to those young phenoms and the recent onslaught of them that we've had the pleasure of witnessing. I'll first talk to Jason Parks from Baseball Prospectus about what it's like to follow these players through the minors and his thoughts on the next crop of phenoms. Then, new sensation Yasiel Puig is perhaps the most electrifying young player in the game, and musician Ian Miller was so impressed that he decided to show his admiration in an unusual way. And I talked to Chris Swick about his experience working for the Washington Nationals while two of their brightest stars came up to the majors. All that, plus the MVP of my heart, it's all coming up on Stealing Home. Let's play ball. It's almost always the case that every great young player was once a great young prospect. We don't quite have the technology yet to make them out of whole cloth. They must be found, they must be cultivated and groomed. And then there's a whole lot of luck that needs to happen too. Not so long ago, we didn't know about most prospects, save for a newspaper report during spring training or their eventual call-up. There just wasn't that much to be read about them. But like so many things, that all changed with the internet. Because we now have a way to effectively relay reports from the minor leagues, it's nearly impossible not to get wrapped up in prospect buzz. In the past, scouts were the only ones watching these guys, Now anybody with a car and a little money for a radar gun can bring back the latest from the farm. I do some writing for Fangraphs, and every year a bunch of writers meet in spring training in Arizona for a little get-together. It was there this year that I met some of the prospect writers for Fangraphs. But I didn't see much of them. They got up before I did, and came back to the hotel long after I had hunkered down for the night. They were at B-games and backfields taking copious notes for the many articles they would write that spring. And they aren't doing it for their health. Fans are eating this stuff up. We need more info, not just on the players on the roster now, but on those that will be impact pieces in the future. We need this information. And we need people to feed it to us. That's where Jason Parks comes in. He's a prospect analyst for Baseball Prospectus. He works tirelessly all year round to bring people the latest on the brightest stars of the future. He was in New Britain, Connecticut, actually, when we spoke on the phone. Jason, thanks for joining me on Stealing Home.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Anytime.
So we've been talking about this new wave of phenoms that has come into the league recently. And as a prospect analyst, you've seen a lot of these guys on the back end before they even made the majors. Have you noticed a kind of a rise in just the quality of prospects in the last few years as well?
Yeah, I mean, I have. Players are getting stronger, faster. They've been playing baseball longer. Their skill sets are more precocious at a younger age. They're more refined at a younger age. And so you're seeing like these, I don't want to say complete. I think complete is a dangerous word, but you're seeing more complete ball players at a younger age. That's why a lot of these players are able to get to major league level and contribute at such a young age. Because they're prepared. They're not players that have, you know, one or two tools that they're still trying to, you know, they're still trying to refine. They're still trying to learn how to play the game. They're not emotionally mature. I mean, a lot of these guys, especially like the stateside guys and even some of the international guys, I mean, they've been playing baseball for a very long time. They've been playing on showcase levels for a very long time. They're not afraid of competition. They've been playing at a high level for a very long time against high-level competition. So they're able to move a lot faster than players, you know, even 10 years ago.
But it's not even just their baseball skills, just the fact that they can achieve what they can achieve at such a young age. Like, I mean, to come up at 20 or 21, I mean, you know, or a guy like Matt Harvey, I think, is 24 even, which is still incredibly young. Is there extra preparation in that goes into these players for preparing them to be, you know, to make at least more money than they're making now, to be kind of in the spotlight as a professional baseball player, even at such a young age?
I mean, yeah, there is that. And then there's also exceptionalism. I mean, we're looking at like the cream of the crop. A guy like Matt Harvey, I mean, yeah, he didn't make it up at 17. You know, he's a guy who decided that, you know, he was set to be a first round talent. You know, he ended up going to college and refining those skills and becoming even better. And then he kind of exploded on the scene. I mean, and his talent is, you know, he's able to do a lot of things that most people aren't. I mean, he's exceptional, even at the major league level. I mean, because he seems to, you know, he's got like that Verlander trait where, you know, he kind of gets stronger. He's a true power pitcher. Like once he starts going, it's like, oh man, Harvey's in a rhythm. You know what that means. Start texting people because it's time to start watching him. He has that. So I think he stands above the rest. I mean, obviously he's not as young as, you know, a Machado or a Trout or a Harper or guys like that, or a Profar. But, you know, I mean, he is relatively young considering the success he is having. I think about this a little bit, like, I wonder what would have happened if he would have gone into the professional ranks instead of going to North Carolina.
It's such a weird thing. I mean, even at 24, man, that's just, I can't imagine what I would have been doing at 24 if I had even a little bit of money. I mean, geez.
Well, I know what I was doing at 24 without money and without that sort of exceptional talent on a physical level. I'm just telling you right now, based on my makeup, I would have ruined the opportunity. I had Harvey's skill set. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
It takes special makeup. You know, that's another thing that gets lost here. It takes special makeup to be able to, you know, reconcile and understand and, you know, work with that sort of exceptional physical gift. You know, he knows what he can do. I mean, when you can throw a baseball that hard and that often, when you can make balls break like that, when you can find that sort of success at the major league level, you have to have some sort of balance in your approach, you know, your emotional approach, your mental approach, because if not, I mean, you know, that sort of success, that sort of, you know, prowess or exceptionalism can really ruin somebody if you don't have the makeup for it. I mean, you can just burn yourself out because you go out thinking that you're absolutely untouchable or invincible.
And I have to think it's harder. Like think about guys like Cespedes or Puig who leave their countries. I mean, and not just like take off, but like defect from their home countries and come over. And I mean, when did Puig get signed? It wasn't that long ago. 2011, maybe? Or no, 2012. So he's only been...
It was 2012. It was before the Fall Instructional League. I mean, that's when he was finally granted, citizenship elsewhere. And so he was allowed to sign. But yeah, these kids, I mean, especially the Cuban guys, man, we don't even know the half of the narrative. I mean, we get to read the narrative and we're like, oh, that's sad. We have no idea how bad it actually is. I mean, Puig was basically on house arrest, you know, and he got all fat. And when I saw Puig, and this is, you know, completely fair to the scouting guys who missed on Puig, but, you know, I talked to guys who are like, man, this guy's got like a $50,000 valuation, or I wouldn't give you more than 50, because he looks fat. Because he was fat, because he was out of shape, because he was sitting around, you know, because he was trying to survive for 2 years. You know, that's what he was trying to do. And then once he got all chiseled up, I mean, now he's, you know, doing some dangerous things. But a lot of teams missed on him because of the way his body looked at the time.
And just to come over and you talk about mental makeup, you know, to come over and not be able to speak the language and just to produce produce the way, I mean, I know what Puig's doing is pretty unsustainable, I get that, but I mean, just to even not fall totally flat on your face is an achievement in and of itself.
Well, I mean, absolutely, and like to take it even on a smaller level, I mean, I get to see all these 16, 17, 18-year-old Latin American kids, especially Dominican kids, that come over to either the instructional league or the complex level, and, you know, a lot of these kids, I mean, the majority of these kids are poorly educated. They've never had any kind of money. So now that they have a little bit of money, they're in Disneyland. You know, they're in a world where, you know, there's a McDonald's, there's a Burger King, there's all these things, and they have access to all of these things. You know, and that's one of the real dangers of player development. That's one of the real struggles of player development, is the acclimation of, you know, that sort of talent from, you know, that socioeconomic climate that they're coming from. It's very, very difficult to assimilate these players into U.S. culture. And that's a big, big challenge in baseball. And when you take a Cuban player who haven't had access to hardly anything in their entire life, I mean, that compounds it. Then they're usually a lot older, you know, getting their birth certificates is very, very difficult. It's not like you can call the Cuban government and say, yeah, you know, this player just defected, but can I go ahead and get his accurate birth records? Because, you know, it doesn't really work that way. So it's anybody's guess. I mean, I'm being honest, like people have an idea of how old some of these players are, but you can't really be certain about the Cuban players.
You were having a discussion either on the most recent episode of your podcast or maybe one before that with your co-host, Mike Farron, about you were having a discussion about how people, when new prospects come up, now everyone's getting unfairly compared to some of the big guys. You know, is so-and-so the next Mike Trout? Is so-and-so the next Manny Machado? And you brought up something which kind of blew my mind, where you said, yeah, it's likely that prospects coming up aren't going to be this good forever, but what if they are? And that's something that, like, I actually took pause and thought, oh, my God, like, it's still a possibility. You know what I mean? I mean, and obviously it's a remote possibility, but I mean, it seems to me, and I think you would agree that the bigger names coming up are just going to be better than the big names that came up 10 years ago.
Yeah. And there's no question. I mean, a lot of that has to do with what we were discussing earlier about, you know, people are bigger, stronger, They have more access to more information at a younger age. They're being, you know, the entire process has been escalated, not only at the amateur level through showcases, through Buscones, but through the professional levels too. You know, teams have, you know, more pressure to bring up younger players now. And, you know, there's a lot of advantages to that. There's a lot of disadvantages to that as well. But just as an example, as we were discussing before we started, I'm in New Britain right now, sitting on the Twins AA affiliate and the Phillies AA affiliate. And I've been here for 2 days, and I've seen two games and two BPs. And I've seen Miguel Sano, who's a 20-year-old third baseman, hit three bombs in games that haven't landed yet. You know, this, I mean, and I'm telling you that this guy is a star. He is going to be a superstar player at the major league level, and it's going to happen pretty soon. I mean, it's not going to happen when he's 23. It's going to happen next year. He's going to come up and do some damage, you know, when he's 21 years old, and he's going to be yet another one of those guys. You know, Byron Buxton is going to be yet another one of these guys. You know, Profar is really starting to develop at the major league level. He's another one of those guys. Oscar Tavares is another one of these guys. You know, and that's not even counting guys like, you know, Raul Alberto Mondesi, who's 17 playing in the Sally League. You know, he could be up by the time he's 20. Julio Urias is a 16-year-old that the Dodgers have who's pitching in full season ball. He could be pitching at the major league level by the time he's 18.
Jeez.
This is nuts.
Well, I certainly, this is certainly an exciting time to be a baseball fan, and I look forward.
No question.
And I look forward to reading your reports on these players and all the players that you see, because it's truly a great thing to keep up on. Jason Parks is the head of minor league coverage and player development for baseballprospectus.com. He's also the co-host of the very excellent Fringe Average podcast, which you can find at baseballprospectus.com or on iTunes. A little bit of a salty language warning on that one for those with sensitive ears. And you can follow him on Twitter at Professor Parks. Jason, thank you so much for joining me.
Of course, man. Anytime. This was fun.
Pardon the cliche, but unless you've been living under a rock recently, you've undoubtedly heard of the exploits of the Dodgers' newest outfielder, Yasiel Puig. As of this recording, Puig has played in 26 games, has 44 hits, 13 of them for extra bases, is hitting .436, slugging .713, and has 4 steals to boot. And just like that, America has caught Puig fever. On episode 2 of Stealing Home, I talked about how no one really writes songs about baseball players anymore, how they've fallen out of the collective consciousness enough that they're no longer immortalized in music. Well, two men decided to change all that. Ian Miller is the bassist for the band Kowloon Walled City, but also runs a baseball website and podcast called Productive Outs with his friend Riley Breckenridge, the drummer for the band Thrice. And when Puig Sanity hit in full force, they put their musical talents together to form Puig Destroyer. The band name and the style, known as grindcore, come as a play on words of the band Pig Destroyer. And Miller and Breckenridge found out a way to match the intensity of Puig's debut in some equally intense music. Here's a sample. That's the song One Man, Five Tools, which is the first track of Puig Destroyer's upcoming EP. In a few short days, the band's popularity has skyrocketed, being passed around all over the internet and even being mentioned in national media. I spoke with Ian Miller about the incarnation of the band and just how big it's become in such a short amount of time. Ian, thanks so much for joining me on Stealing Home.
Thanks for having me, David. It's my pleasure.
Can you tell me a little bit about how Puig Destroyer got started?
Of course, yeah. So Riley Breckenridge, erstwhile drummer of Thrice, and myself do a Twitter feed and website and podcast called Productive Outs. A couple of weeks ago, we were recording episode 49, and Yasiel Puig was, you know, doing Yasiel Puig type things. And there's a longtime grindcore grind band called Pig Destroyer. And Riley tossed off this comment about, wouldn't it be funny if someone did a grindcore band called Puig Destroyer, ha ha ha. And we both thought it was hilarious. And later that night, around midnight, Riley sent me drum tracks for our first song. So it went from, you know, idea to concept in the works to, I think it was 9 days later that we released our first song on Bandcamp.
And after you released the song, to me, it seemed almost instantaneous, but you would probably have a better recollection of just how quickly this whole thing kind of blew up. How long did it take for all these people to realize what you were doing?
Yeah, the reaction was totally crazy. I think it was just dumb luck on our parts. Like we, the rest of the stuff that happened was, so Riley sent me the drum tracks. I wrote a bunch of riffs. We sent them to Mike Minnick, who used to sing for Curl Up and Die, who's a personal friend of mine and even more so of Riley's. And then I enlisted the help of John Howell, who plays in my actual band, Kowloon Walled City, to do the guitar stuff. So within like 5 or 6 days, we had basic tracks for everything. And a couple more days, Mike laid down the vocals and we released the song. And we put it out on a slow news day, like a Friday. And I was worried that no one was going to hear it because Fridays are the days that you typically take out the trash and right, things get, you know, swept under the rug. So, but no, the opposite happened. We released it on a Friday morning and the internet kind of went haywire over it. A few days later, we ended up getting mentioned on SportsCenter. And probably the highlight of the whole thing was Yasiel himself listening to the song at the MLB Fan Cave, and somebody, the whoever's in there representing the Blue Jays, I think her name is April, maybe, she posted a Vine video of Yasiel listening to the song and saying, "That's very good." So that was probably the craziest thing that's happened. So, you know, from joke on podcast to the ball player himself hearing it in like 10 days. Totally nuts, yeah.
So the style of the band obviously came from the fact that you're parodying the name of another band.
Yeah.
But grindcore is certainly, and all its, you know, permutations, is certainly has a certain aesthetic to it. Is it something that you've had experience in the past, or is this kind of a somewhat new genre you had to pick up on?
Well, I'm not. Here's the thing. A lot of people who are steeped in various heavy metal genres will tell you that what we've done so far with Puig Disorder isn't legitimate grindcore, and they very well may be right. Grind is super fast, like way over 200 beats a minute. The songs are typically very short, and the vocals, you know, are performed in a specific way. I mean, I think, to me, it's reminiscent of Pig Destroyer, and there's another metal band that's making the rounds right now called Nails, who, you know, reminds me of, or, you know, who I was trying to channel when I was writing these things. And so, you know, it may not meet all of the various criteria to be called grindcore. To me, it's more just like hardcore and metal, sort of the stuff that I grew up on. In the 90s, I played in a band called Redemption 87, and we were... Gosh, I don't know. We were trying to recall late 80s New York hardcore. And so I'm certainly steeped in all of that stuff. And those are the kinds of things that I recalled as I, you know, wrote the riffs for Puig Destroyer. But we were trying to get in the ballpark of Pig Destroyer. You know, we did this whole thing like in a couple of days. So... you know, if we didn't achieve the exact aesthetic, you'll just have to forgive us.
Well, and play, you know, the play on the words aside, Yasiel Puig is certainly someone who has made a name for himself in a very short amount of time. And, you know, if anybody was worthy of having a band pretty much started in his name, He would certainly be one. Was it just based on the conversation you guys were having, or is he somebody that really struck a chord with you as a baseball fan?
Oh, the latter, absolutely. I mean, he's electric. Watching him play is crazy. He's incredibly talented and incredibly raw, and sort of doesn't play the game. He's creating his own aesthetic as well. He's not necessarily playing by the unwritten rules, like, you know, trying to stretch singles into doubles constantly and throwing behind guys, trying to get guys out at first base from right field. He's so gifted athletically that he's able to do all these things that, you know, normal mere mortals, baseball players who are each of them, you know, among the 1,000 best baseball players on the planet, even those guys can't typically do. So he's incredible to watch. And it's convenient that he's stayed hot and stayed in the headlines, at least for us. It seems highly unlikely that he'll be able to maintain this kind of pace that he's on right now. But I think it's our job as baseball fans to enjoy this while it lasts, and to, you know, wring the most enjoyment out of it that we can. It's fantastic.
You are on the West Coast. I know you're a little north of the LA area. Have you gotten to see him in person yet?
I haven't, no. Very much looking forward to it. We're giant season ticket holders in this household, so I'm sure I'll get a chance to see him when he's up here. And I probably won't be able to get away with cheering for him in my section, but I'll just cheer for him quietly to myself.
And now, something like this, I've heard stories of, you know, I don't want to say side projects, but I'll just use that term
for the sake
of clarity. People have started these so-called side projects just on a whim, as like a fun thing to do. But now, at least in our very small community, or you know, two small communities, you guys have blown up, I guess is the phrase to use. So what are the plans for the group? Are you going to make more tracks? Are you going to you already have T-shirts for sale? What's right. next for Puig Destroyer?
Well, we do have basics for either 5 or 6 songs. And Mike from our singer is doing vocals for them, maybe even right now as we speak. Scott Evans, who is the main dude in Kowloon Walled City, my quote unquote real band, is a gifted engineer and mixer in his own right, and he's going to produce the record. So the plan in the near term is to get these additional 4 or 5 songs finished up, post them on Bandcamp. And we are now talking to friends with record labels about a physical release. We're hoping to do at least a 7-inch. And beyond that, we feel like there's obviously there's a market for this stuff. I mean, a market sounds sort of mercenary. Believe me, none of us are going to get rich off of this. But like you said, it struck a chord with people. People seem to want to hear more, so we're happy to make more loud, fast songs about baseball. So short terms, this digital release, put it on a 7-inch and write more songs, I hope.
Ian Miller is the bassist for Kowloon Walled City and the co-proprietor of Productive Outs and the corresponding podcast, The Prodcast. You can find all that at productiveouts.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at @teen_archer. Ian, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, David. Thanks again for having me.
When great young players come up, we often think about how it affects us as fans. But there's a whole other side to it. When somebody big is ready to make their debut, a lot of preparation goes on behind the scenes, too. To get a better glimpse of this, I talked to Chris Swick. He's a writer for CBSSports.com and Fangraphs, but a few years ago, he was a scoreboard operator for the Washington Nationals. And he was there when it was not only an exciting time to be a Nats fan, but a Nats employee as well. Chris, thanks for joining me on Stealing Home.
Hey, David, great to be here.
Now, you were a scoreboard operator for the Washington Nationals for a couple years, and you were kind of in the pocket for two interesting years, years that saw the rise of two really highly touted prospects in Steven Strasburg and Bryce Harper. And in fact, when you started with the Nationals, your official start date was put off by Strasburg's debut. Is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of a long story. You know, this is what I did. This is what I studied in college. I worked for the Brewers briefly, and I was still there with the Brewers. And I got a call in like April of that year from the Nationals saying, you know, we're interested in having you come in and interview. I called back a bunch of times, didn't hear anything until literally July. And when I first talked to the man that would eventually become my boss, he said, hey, sorry, we couldn't have you in earlier. The Strasburg debut was so crazy on our end that we just did not have time to interview people. And so a month after that, I was eventually hired. But I was not there for the Strasburg debut, which I hear was just a fantastic event.
But you were there for Bryce Harper when he did finally come up. And as a behind-the-scenes kind of guy, I mean, we all know kind of as fans how we prepare for, well, even, you know, somebody like a Strasburg or a Harper. When they come up, fans know about it ahead of time. They get excited. You know, they're ready to see these guys play. But from the on the other side, from the kind of the front office team organizational side, there's got to be a lot of prep work that goes into this kind of occasion when a Bryce Harper comes up from the minors.
There is, you know, we got a lot of our video in spring training of like the players that and then you build your player walk up videos. So when they're walking up to the plate, that's all done in house for the most part. At least at the Nationals, it is. So we get footage of Harper then, but what happens is you have about a month to make all of the opening day roster. So you're working on probably 30 to 35 videos because you don't know who's going to make it. So I can't even remember if we had Harper done, but once you find out that he's coming up, you have to work on that stuff. You have to make sure that he has a major league headshot. So it's not necessarily just like the editors in the back, but we have another company that works on some of those things. So it's a lot of work being put in. And on top of that, then you're sitting around saying, okay, in Harper's case, he debuted on the road for two games. But then you're sitting around saying, okay, we need to talk to him when he gets back. We need to put together a video on his major league debut. We need to ask him about playing here. And all this other stuff. And the other crazy thing is that you know that the stadium's going to be packed. So it kind of makes you, at least from our end in the scoreboard, it makes you raise your game because you know there are now 40,000 people sitting there and they're going to dissect your every move. And if you screw up, it's going to be on some Washington Post blog the next day.
I didn't even think about it that way because I mean, so many eyes are on him when he starts playing. But because of that, I imagine. I mean, not that you know, people who work in ballparks are never not giving their best. But it makes you think that you really gotta bring your A game because all eyes are not only on him, but all eyes are on you too.
Yeah, absolutely. After doing it, I obviously have a lot of respect for those people. I know how hectic it can be at times. I mean, in Harper's case, you know, it's not like we're getting a ton of warning on him coming up. Yes, we have a couple days because he was on the road. But, you know, in some cases, you're literally just kind of flying by the seat of your pants and hoping that everything comes together. Mistakes are made, obviously, because it's a live show. So as much as you can be prepared for it, that's going to happen. But for the most part, you know, I think for the most part, people are forgiving. But if you make a big mistake, obviously, then that's going to be somewhere.
Now, you're not, I mean, obviously you worked for the Nationals then, but you were and still are a baseball fan. So if you can take off kind of your Nationals employee hat for a second, remembering back, what was it like just as a fan Maybe not even for that first day, but just those first few days, just to realize, you know, what you were witnessing and kind of the historical importance of where you were at that time.
Well, I know that this isn't, I guess this isn't Strasburg or Harper related, but my first game there, I got to work a game where they inducted Andre Dawson. It might have been Andre Dawson Day. It was something with him, and I remember standing on the field, just a complete fan moment, thinking Andre Dawson and Gary Carter are on this field. They're doing a tribute to Andre Dawson. This is the greatest thing that I have ever been involved in. And, you know, it's obviously, it's the same way with, like, with Harper. That first game, you hear the fans go nuts for him. And I remember his dad saying, I think I saw this afterward, but his dad said something like that was the first time that Bryce was cheered in a park, because his reputation. So on the road, he would get booed all the time, and that was the first time that you saw the fans cheer. And it's just kind of a ridiculous moment where even though, you know, I have to stay focused, I have to get my job done, you still let the fan side slide in a little bit.
Well, Chris, it was great talking to you about how the other side lives, so to speak, when a big stud prospect comes up for the minors. Thank you so much for joining me on Stealing Home.
Hey, David, thanks for having me on. Anytime you need me, I'm here for you.
Chris Swick is a writer for CBSSports.com as well as Fangraphs.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris_Swick. Swick is spelled C-W-I-K. To end every episode, I like to take a look at someone who, for actions on the field or off, deserve a little love. It's the MVP of my heart. I often catch myself wondering about the next great baseball player, what he'll look like, where he'll come from. But no matter what he looks like or what position he plays, he'll look a lot like his predecessors, just a better version. He'll be a center fielder with just a little more speed, or a first baseman with just a little more power. That's the way baseball works. You're the best until someone a little younger and a little better comes along. So no matter how you picture the next big thing, he probably looks a lot like someone else you've seen. But there's this kid named Baker. Baker's just a teenager, but already has an impressive track record as a Little League pitcher, with two complete games and averaging two strikeouts an inning. People are speculating whether this kid is going to go to college or just turn pro right away. But the pro option on the table is unique in that it's a chance to play in Japan, not Major League Baseball. And the contract is there, waiting to be signed, even though Baker is just 16 years old. See, a lot of people wonder if Baker will ever get a chance in Major League Baseball. That's because of Baker's first name, Chelsea. Chelsea Baker isn't one of those girl better than all the boys on her team stories that we hear from time to time. Because the most interesting facet of Chelsea's game isn't her gender, but her pitching. Specifically, the fact that she throws a knuckleball. A knuckleball the late Joe Niekro taught her to throw when she was just 7 years old. There is exactly one knuckleballer currently in the majors today, R.A. Dickey. And Dickey is very good. But he, like every other knuckleballer, didn't start off throwing that pitch. Knucklers find the flutter pitch after failing to be productive throwing all other pitches. Tim Wakefield was a failed infielder before he found his pitch. The knuckleball is never part of Plan A, but it is for Chelsea Baker. While the knuckler can be a career saver for some, it's the great equalizer for Chelsea. There's a good chance she won't be able to throw pitches by the boys with blazing speed, so she uses deception. And if she's able to defy an impossible set of odds, if she can prove herself worthy to get a shot at the very best hitters in the game, she'll single-handedly change the definition of a phenom. there have already been a fair amount of stories about Chelsea Baker. And if she goes any further, there will be plenty more. Things in baseball and away from it are just going to keep getting harder for her. Hell, high school is hard enough. But I, for one, hope she sticks with it. A rookie knuckleballer would be awesome to see. But a woman in the big leagues, one who could not only break down baseball's last big barrier, but who could do it while mowing down the boys, that would be incredible. There will be backlash, sure, and I'm sure there'll be some terribly hacky newspaper columns as well. The one on the front lines is the first to get a bullet in the chest. And of course, people will be waiting to jump on her the moment she fails. But like I said, hope is all about possibilities. And the mere fact that Chelsea Baker even has a small chance to break the gender barrier and do it throwing the coolest pitch in baseball, to me, already makes her a phenom. And the MVP of my heart. Stealing Home is produced and hosted by David Temple. Hey, that's me. A big thanks to Jason Parks, Ian Miller, and Chris Swick, and to my friend Mike Bates for suggesting the theme of this episode. If you'd like to suggest a theme for the show, or if you want show notes for this episode or episodes past, you can do so by going to stealinghome.org. I read all of your suggestions, I promise. Even if I don't get back to you, I am filing them away for future ideas. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stealinghomeradio or on Twitter at twitter.com/stealinghomeorg. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you all next time on Stealing Home.